people who have actually done those beautiful murals that you see over here that are one-time graffiti artists, now muralists, and some of the neon sign makers, to kind of give you a sense of what some of the great stories are that made New York so distinctive. And to host today's discussion, we have Elena Martinez with us today, and she's going to be the folklorist who's hosting the discussion.
Hi, today we have with us Robbie and Teresa Ingwe, who work for Artistic Neon. It's located in Ridgewood, Queens, which is like right on the border of Queens and Brooklyn. And we also have Wise and Nicer, who are part of Tat's Crew, a graffiti collective company that works out of Hunts Point in the Bronx, and they're located at The Point, which is a community center located in Hunts Point. And today's talk will just be a little bit about some of the artistic kinds of art that artistic expressions and kinds of art that you see in an urban environment. We're dealing with some forms of art that actually they're all over. They're all throughout the United States, throughout the world. But they're really known. They were really kind of gave their character to New York and really be kind of started in New York. And first, we'll talk with Robbie and Teresa about the neon sign business. And New York, when everyone thinks of New York, a lot of times they think of the bright lights and signs, places like Times Square, and that's kind of the neon look. And we'll talk about, maybe Robbie can tell us a little bit about kind of the history of neon in New York City, like kind of how it started, what kind of businesses used neon, and where it's going today.
Okay. How you doing, folks? My name's Robbie Ingwe, my wife Teresa. We run Artistic Neon in New York. This company was passed on by my dad, who's been in the neon business for 50 years, and he has seen a lot of changes in the industry. Well, neon was invented in the early 1920s, came to America in the late 1920s, and I would say back then, New York was it. I mean, now you have Las Vegas as a distant second, but New York was really the happening place to have neon. You had so many kinds of businesses, all different kinds of businesses, not specific districts of just these businesses. So it was a big mishmash, and everybody had to stand out. So what did they do? They invested in neon. Well, in the 60s, the plastics industry came about, and neon kind of hit a little decline, also in the 70s. Well, that's when my father started Artistic Neon in 71. He's also been through a lot of ups and downs in the business, but now business is pretty steady, and there's a constant demand for neon. In the early 70s, soon after my dad opened up the company, he started to teach neon at the Experimental Glass Workshop, which was a division of the New School for Social Research. And he used to be their teacher. For I'd say about 10 years, he taught neon. He really put his heart into it, and a lot of people actually, I would say a good dozen people, had learned and taken it to opening up their own business, as opposed to just having it as something that they know under their belt. So he really, he's what I call a Renaissance man. In the 70s, as he was teaching, he was also doing a lot of delving into things like neon coffee tables, for people's homes, three-dimensional neon works, things that, you know, neon under glass blocks, things that really in the early 70s, nobody knew what they were. They were amazed by these things because everybody thought of neon as just signage. And, of course, neon was slowly resurging at that point. And my dad is the Renaissance man. I've coined that term for him, and he is, I feel, solely responsible for the rebirth of neon in the 70s. And then in the 80s, I apprenticed about 6 to 7 years. Then he retired, and I've been doing it about 17 years now.
Did you know you were going to go into neon right away and take over the business?
No, actually, I didn't. There's a little bit of a... Now that you pulled it out of me, I have to say it. Well, I was going to college to be a oceanographer. I wanted to swim with the fishes. I was very good at biology, and that's what I wanted to do with my life. Then I found out you had to take a lot of calculus, and I lost interest really fast. And also, as Teresa will add quickly...
not to mention that he got seasick in the bay, so oceanographer, a little tricky business for him.
And I wound up marrying a commercial fisherman's daughter. Go figure. Although she hasn't put any sea legs into me, I still get seasick after all these years. Well, I've been doing this about 17 years now. My wife came on board about 3-4 years ago, and she really added a new dimension to the business with her artwork, because she's an actual, I won't call her a trained artist, because she was born as an artist. She could just do what she's got to do. Whereas myself, I had to go to school to learn how to be an artist. She just has it in her blood. It's running through her veins. We deal with pretty much all kinds of businesses, right, Teresa?
We deal with a lot of different businesses. And in New York, it's in the sign industry, I feel it's a good way for me to express my art in the glass because of the fact we have a lot of people who don't speak English. So if you have a business, you want everyone to know what you're selling. So there's
picture
a lot
says
of
a thousand
artwork.
Words.
There's a lot of artwork that goes into it. You know, it may be commercial art, like hamburgers, a cup of coffee, a hero sandwich, or a pizza pie. But this lets the mass of people that are in the city understand what you're selling, because you can't expect everyone to understand English.
Can you guys talk to us a little bit about the business side of the business, of the neon sign business? How do you have to, you know, make the deals to make the to get clients and that sort of thing?
Well, getting business, okay.
It's not easy.
First of all, getting people to part with their money for anything is like pulling teeth. Some people have to be convinced a little harder than others that spending $1,000 on a neon sign is worth it. I happened to be in a store here in Georgetown the other night, and this guy, we saw his neon sign. We went in, we spent a couple hundred bucks, and he looked at me, he says, "You're from New York, aren't you?" I says, "Yeah." I says, "You know what brought me in? Your neon sign in the window." He says, "Jesus." He says, "That stuff is expensive." I looked at him and I says, "Hey, man, I'm blue collar. That stuff is not expensive. I know it's not. If it was expensive, I would, I'd be in an office now counting my money. I wouldn't have dirt under my fingernails. I still work every day." And he says, "That stuff is real expensive." I says, "Well, let me guess what you paid for that sign." I says, "Do you remember?" He says, "Yeah, I remember." I says, "Okay." I looked at it. I figured out. I spent a couple seconds. I says, "You paid about $800 for that sign." He says, "I paid $725. I says, "Wow." I says, "And how long have you had that sign?" He said to me, "Let's see. I've had it 7 years, maintenance free, which is great. Neon is maintenance free." I says, "So that's $100 a year." He says, "Yeah, that's $100 a year." I says, "What kind of advertising do you get for $8 a month?" I says, "Does that sign bring you $8 a month in business?" He looked at me. He shook my hand. He says, "You're a businessman, aren't you?" He says. So I kind of convinced him. Even after 7 years, he still thinks the sign is expensive. It cost him $8 a month. So the different types of people that we deal with have different cultures, different ways. Teresa could add there.
Well, different cultures and different ways actually depends on how we're going to deal with maybe getting a job, actually. You realize some people are going to want to haggle your price. Some people will just pay your price.
You. Okay. Right.
So it's a lot of different ways, you know, you have to feel it out. It's you got a lot of competition in New York. Like the saying says, you know, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. Because even though, you know, we have an established business, there are virtually hundreds of sign companies in the phone book. And if you look in the phone book, you know, you'll see a lot of like companies, AAA signs, A this, A that, because they want to be the first one on the page.
They make their name with three A's in it, so they're Don Well, the first person in the book, and that's their whole, anyway. So how are they going to pick you? You know, you hope that they pick you out of the book. As far as small neon manufacturers, like myself and my father, you know, one-man, two-man shops, they're non-existent. But there are hundreds of shops that advertise neon.
Oh, so there's no actually handmade, bended glass
no,
makers in the city?
No, there are other neon shops in the city. But as far as, like, small, traditional, passed-on neon shops, there's a couple at best. Most of the shops are big shops with guys that are just paid to be glass benders. And all those guys do is bend glass all day. And, of course, they got salesmen who do the selling and layout people who do the layouts, yada, yada. Whereas small, traditional, one at a time. You know, we know all our customers individually. Kind of shops are pretty non-existent in New York.
And if I might add, most of these companies, they'll keep people working maybe like on a production line. Maybe one person will be making a U-bend. Maybe somebody's going to make a double back or a splice. So everybody really doesn't know the whole craft right. In the other sign
They
companies.
Keep them at a certain level that way.
And then what happens is these people, maybe they'll get some experience and they're fed up with the factory scene and they open up a business on their own. They'll produce some glass and it'll work for a while.
A lot of straight lines.
Eventually it's not going to work anymore. And that's when Robbie's recommendations come in. Most of our business is done on recommendations and word of mouth because that's the way New York is. Things just travel through the streets. Robbie's now known as just Robbie Lights. Not artistic neon. You have to have Robbie Lights make you sign. He does it right. He's going to do you right. It's going to work for you. If you're on a street and maybe your signs are broken all the time and you're looking across the street at someone else's store who's been there and you never see a problem with his neon sign, you're going to go in there and say, hey, who makes your signs? And most of the times, maybe it's going to be Mr. Robbie here making the...
Hopefully.
making the signs that doesn't break.
I just have one more question, but I just want to let everyone know, if you guys have any questions at any time for any of the artists up here, just shout out and you can try to answer it. One other question is just that now that New York has kind of changed in the past few years, people have seen Disney move into Times Square, and some people have complained about that. A lot of mom-and-pop stores have closed down. Has that, when you have these big corporate chains and that sort of stuff in the city, has that changed the business, changed the kinds of signs you're making, the kind of clientele that you work with?
Kind of, in a way. It definitely has changed other businesses. A lot of hardware stores, mom-and-pop hardware stores are gone because Home Depot came along and they sell for less than the mom-and-pop stores could do. I haven't made many hardware store signs, I could say. But generally, my clients are not corporate. I have maybe a half a dozen mega conglomerate corporate clients that I deal with. Most of my, 80-90% of my business is... mom and pop stores, thankfully, New York, right, is still dominated by.
Yes, it's dominated by the mom and pop stores. And if I might add, like Robbie's saying about the Home Depot, just when the Home Depot started up, we had noticed that we were making a lot of hardware signs right before they all went out because they were really, really trying to keep their heads above water.
Yeah.
And we find that in the neon business and advertising, when the economy isn't too good for the mom-and-pop stores, that's when the business is good for us. So people are trying to keep their heads above water, but sometimes the corporations take them over. But then other businesses come in and fill up that space where the hardware store was. Now we have a big
stores.
Run of telecommunications, cell phones. So where one business goes out, there's always something that's going to come in, and you're going to be making a new kind of sign to break up your monotony, so to say.
New York has no... lack of entrepreneurial shipmanshipism.
Well, another art form that we'll be talking about is graffiti. And I think one of the images that come to mind for many people when they think of New York City are the subway trains, like during the 70s, that were just had tags and graffiti sprawled all over the inside of the cars. And we'll ask some questions to Nicer and Wise. And if you guys could tell us a little bit about how graffiti was used on the subway train, the tagging, as well as the pieces that were made on the outside of the cars, and talk about your experience with the subway.
Right. Well, we started. I started painting subway trains in 1980. It sort of started as a subculture. It wasn't the general, normal, everyday person. Had no interest in this art form. I mean, it was just we saw the artistic value in it. When I started, it was by chance that one day, I got on the train with, my family, and, the doors closed as we were leaving. I turned around, and there was this huge lettering on the side of the train, and these cartoon characters, they sort of, reminded me of, a comic book cover. So I walked away, and I was, overwhelmed, wow, what was that? You know what I mean? Meanwhile, I'm being dragged along. So that sort of, piqued my interest. Graffiti was being practiced from the 60s on. So we're sort of the third generation that came along. When it started, if you look at the overall timeline of graffiti, It started, you know, it's gone through an evolution. So it started as just someone writing their name, you know, and simply enough as that. The art form is an art form of calligraphy, in a sense, because what you do is you try to stylize an alphabet and try to camouflage lettering. And so it's sort of like a calligraphy sort of formatted, you know, art form. But the originators sort of started it with just one stroke, you know, lettering. And someone else saw that, and they said, well, you know, that looks cool. I'm going to add another color to it, and I'm going to outline that. And then someone else saw that and said, well, I'm going to do those two steps, but I'm going to do stars in the middle of it. And then, you know, it just went on and on and on, where now, you know, we're 2001, and actually the kids are designing the stuff on computers now, printing it out, and going out and painting it on walls.
And you guys started your work on subway cars too, right?
Right, right. We painted from 1980 to 1986, which was the very last that the MTA let trains ride with any graffiti on it. By then, we already had taken it to such a different level where, you know, there were, you know, the composition was no longer just, you know, based on a name. It was basically there were backgrounds and foregrounds and, you know, characters, and they started, taking shape where, you know, it was more defined. So.
A lot of graffiti artists talk about how they liked using the trains because if you lived in the Bronx, you would do a piece on a train and it would travel through Manhattan and Queens and Brooklyn, and it was like your artwork was just being, the whole city was getting a chance to see it. Were you guys conscious of that when you?
Yeah, definitely. It was like, because what ended up happening at the very beginning was that throughout the very ending of painting trains, a lot of times they were just names on subway cars. Or, you know, or images on subway cars. And what ended up happening was, you know, you didn't know, you know, the person. You didn't know the face that was attached to it. It was just names. So, in a lot of different ways, these trains sort of became rolling canvases. So, which was kind of a cool thing because you'll be in Brooklyn somewhere and you'll see someone, you know, that looked like they wrote graffiti, had paint on their sneakers, or, you know, their fingers were, full of ink. And you'll approach them, you're like, you're right. Right is one of the terms, we call each other writers. It's funny how people that are in this art form don't even use the term graffiti a lot. Graffiti was basically a name that was, you know, given to it by the media. And what ended up happening was we call each other writers, because we write on trains, the lettering styles and stuff like that, sort of like writing. And what ended up happening was if I had my way, I would change the name completely and, you know, call it something like aerosol art, which, you know, because, you know, there's one of the things that ends up happening with this art form is that, say, someone that has no interest within the art form stumbles across a spray can and picks it up and goes and writes on a building or on a car or on a church or on a synagogue or something. Right away, they're vandals, but they're called graffiti vandals. And guys like myself and my company and Wise and us, we can paint portraits, we can replicate, you know, photos, we can, you know, create, one-of-a-kind images, you know, all manipulating spray paint, but, you know, the spray can is just our medium. It isn't, you know, our tool for destruction. So what ends up happening is everyone, you know, they look at everything that's done with a spray can and they clump everyone sort of into the same group. And that's one of the things that, you know, we try to do as a company. We try to break that stereotype.
Well, you guys have actually made pieces all around the world. You've been to a lot of different countries. You do murals, beautiful murals, memorial murals,
right.
Commercial murals. But you still have a problem and run into that sometimes where people just consider vandalism?
Yeah, it's funny. We had a call one time. Actually, we had a meeting with a company out of Greenwich, Connecticut. And they came to our office, they looked at the portfolio, we designed some artwork for them, and we were ready to go and proceed with the project. So we drive up to Greenwich, and, you know, we start unloading, and we're getting ready, you know, so that we can start painting. And the woman walks over, and she's like, what's this for? So this is what we're going to use to paint. She's like, spray paint? I'm like, yeah. She's like, oh. You know, like, right away, like, her tone changed. It was like, oh. But, you know, needless to say, we just ignored it, went on and painted. And by the end of the project, you know, they all came. They were like, we have to have you back and you have to do the other wall. And it was kind of, you know, it's cool just to see you know, people's, you know, see them change their perception from the very beginning.
Art transcends all cultures.
See that?
Well, true. You mentioned that it was a kind of calligraphy. Can you guys talk a little bit about the aesthetics? There's different writing in different boroughs and different countries, right. Even. Can you talk a little bit about the different aesthetics of aerosol art?
Yeah. One of the things that you have to keep in mind is that it's one of the art forms that's probably, as far as paint being applied to something, it's probably one of the newest art forms, ever, invented. And what ends up happening is that, it was invented here in the States, in New York City, sort of nourished and grown. And yet there's places throughout Europe that recognize this as a true art form and give it actual space. We've been to places like we did a month-long show in a tour throughout England, which we really traveled the entire English, country. And what ended up happening was we've been to Germany, Paris,
Dublin.
Dublin. We were Amsterdam. There was a few different places, but everywhere you go outside of the United States, everywhere you go outside of the United States, it's sort of received with open arms. But here, there's still this stigma, this stigma that's stuck to it, and that's one of the things that we're trying to.
Well, did the styles that you go when you go to Holland, Germany, all these other places, are they influenced by the stuff that comes from the Bronx and New York City? Or do they have their own styles?
A lot of it, you can see where they take some of the origins from. And one of the things about this art form is individualism. Everyone has their own styles. You know what I mean? So what ends up happening is, even though you can see, traits of, New York City graffiti, they end up, manipulating it to a way where, they're adding their own flavor to it. So you can tell the difference between Japanese graffiti, Australian graffiti, graffiti from L.A.
What are some of those differences? Can you think of anything offhand that are makes them different?
Well, personally, I think it's more than just even a country. It becomes very individualized. Graffiti is name-based. And you don't really start to become famous until you create a style of your own where somebody could just look at your artwork. You can even really do another name. And between the artists, they say, well, that's such and such's work. That's a nicer work, or that's a bio work, or a lumen, or a scene. They start to know their style. And it evolved from New York, whereas you have, there's basics that I guess every graffiti writer learns, You learn to do a piece, then you learn to do 3D, you learn to put an outline on your 3D, and then it evolves from there. If you people had went over and looked at the pictures, some different artists came and collaborated with the Tats crew, and you can see the difference in style. Some Brazilian artists came down from Sao Paulo. They have a different style. Another part of our crew from Germany joined our crew, and they have a different style to them. We've painted with different people, and they have different styles. And you don't really start to become famous until you create a style of your own, become known for your style. Like Tats Crew is known for really doing clean, pure stuff, realistic stuff. And Nice is really famous for his characters, doing characters off the top of his head, going to a wall with no outline, just using spray paint and going up there and doing something off the top of the head.
Well, can you talk a little bit about the memorial walls? I'm not sure if a lot of people here are familiar with them. There's one on the side of the building over there, if you guys want to take a look at it at some point. But can you kind of explain what the memorial walls grew out of?
Yeah. Well, when we started painting for ourselves out in the street, once we stopped painting subway trains, what ended up happening was we were now approachable. It was no longer, a name without a face. we were being asked to paint small signs for local mom and pop grocery stores and supermarkets and stuff like that. So while we were out there painting these jobs, people were approaching us and saying, listen, I have, my brother passed away, or my cousin or my sister, we want to paint a memorial wall. And it started enough, simply enough where we were doing maybe one or two a year. And in 1996, 97.
These really became popular, like in the early 90s or something.
Yeah,
like
because
explosion
there was
of them.
Because what ended up happening, I think for me, what ends up happening to a lot of these walls is once we get asked to paint them and we're in the process of painting them and once we're done painting them, they sort of become for that community a wailing wall or sort of a place where they can go and remember loved ones and sort of, or the person's still within the community, you know what I mean, still part of them and still part of, like, you know, the scenery. So, you know, for everyone who has these things made, I mean, one of the things you have to keep in mind is that for the kids, you know, because they weren't all kids that we were painting on the wall. They were, you know, retirees. They were, you know, mothers. They were daughters. They were, you know, some were, you know, died violently. Some died, you know, natural causes. We did a memorial wall for a 7-year-old boy who died of a spinal, birth defect. And, you know, and while we were painting these things, we don't know we don't know the people that we're actually painting. So what ends up happening is you get information from the families and the friends because you want to be able to capture something in these murals that, you know, everyone can identify and you know they want to be remembered in a certain way. So what ends up happening is by the time you're finished painting these walls, it's like if you knew the person and there was a sense of, you know, wow, I really understood who this person was. And you know, it got to be something where it was part of our business, but it wasn't, you know, like generally set out to be, you know, a sector of our business. But since we were doing so much of it, it got to be something where we had to sit down and decide for ourselves, like, did we want to continue doing this? And do we, you know, I tell you, you know, just to make, you know, things a little lighter here, we got to do so many memorial walls at one time that we would drive through certain neighborhoods and people would stop and walk over to us and like, what are you guys doing here? Did anybody die? And I was like, hey, wait a minute. You know, like, that was sort of like, you know, it got to be something where that wasn't what we wanted to be remembered for. But we ended up doing a lot of memorial walls through 96 all the way to like 98.
So now the majority of your business is commercial?
Yeah.
Enterprise?
Yeah. We do... We've started Tatch Crew as a company. We've been in business for 6 years now. And we've done everything from video music backdrops to stage backdrops for Broadway shows to Madison Square Garden shows to stage sets for, like, you know, anything from rap groups to rock groups. We've done... ad campaigns for companies like Coca-Cola, the House of Seagram's, Reebok. We did a commercial for Reebok. So the client list is kind of, it's everything from, like, you know, the upper crusty to, like, you know, the little, you know, we're still doing work for the mom and pop grocery stores. So it's sort of, we're in the community and, you know, we're just accessible by everybody.
So, well, I don't know if anyone has any questions for them, but... Actually, everyone's probably going to be, they might be leaving early today, so if anyone wants to look at any of their work, any of the artists here, you might want to just go over to their booths to, are you doing the neon demonstrations today at all?
All day.
Oh, you are doing them all day. And you can get a chance to look at all sides of the brownstone are covered with murals, so if you do want to go over there and take a look at them and ask any questions to Tatch Crew, they're over there to do that. So I just want to thank Nicer, Wise, Teresa, and Robbie for coming up to talk today. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, peace.